Said George W. to the NSA.
Do you hear what I hear?
Do you hear what I hear?
Tapping all your phones every day.
Do you hear what I hear?
Do you hear what I hear?
Your calls I hear, crystal clear and loud. Liberals say it isn't allowed.
Richard Nixon would have been proud. Said Dick Cheney to the states of red.
Do you fear what I fear?
Do you fear what I fear?
Bringing us words of fear and dread.
Do you fear what I fear? True, liberals have no clue, and if more states start voting blue, terrorists will be thanking you.
Said George W. when asked of Iraq.
You don't know what I know. If one guy knows nothing, it's me.
Said Dick Cheney when it's time to vote.
Listen to what I say.
Listen to what I say.
Don't make me grab you by the throat. Better vote the right way.
Better vote the right way.
If Democrats win the White House race, it would be a massive disgrace, and I'll shoot some guy in the face.
He will shoot some guy in the face.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching this broadcast, we're listening to Climate Warriors. Michael Mann, Catherine Hayhoe, and Bill Endergreg discuss their experiences as climate scientists in a field under the magnifying glass of politics, economics, and amplified emotions.
Let's ask that of the two professors. Are there...
That's movements? What I'm asking. Yeah. Where is it?
On campus, is this a major issue for students? Are they more concerned about debt, tuition, other...
There was an interesting poll that came out a few months ago. I forget the polling organization, and it looked at concern about climate change in different age groups. And what they found was that acceptance of the science of climate change is actually as high or higher than it's ever been among college students today. So they don't deny that climate change is a threat. But in these times of, in economic slowdown, and when it's difficult to find a job, when there are other sort of bread and butter issues on the table that you're worrying about, it's easy to subjugate something that seems distant and abstract, like climate change. Maybe, the picture changes a bit when it starts to come home, when you have events like Hurricane Sandy, when you have record drought and wildfire, as we saw this last summer. I think people are starting to recognize that this isn't an abstract, far-off problem. It's something that's affecting us now. The acceptance of the existence of the problem is there. It's really the prioritization of acting to solve this problem that is keeping us from making progress right now. And I think that may change with some of what we've seen over the last year.
Catherine Hayhoe or Bill Endergreg?
I agree.
Bill?
I concur. I mean, I think that in general, college campuses and the younger generation is incredibly motivated by this, but that it's these long-term seeming impacts on your career or making a living that really hamper stepping up and taking immediate action. I think it's something that is changing. It's been my perspective over the last 8 or 9 years at Stanford, there's been an incredible change in the community and the student participation. When Steve Schneider taught this course on climate science in an overview, and as he started teaching it, it was 40 or 50 people, and by, I think, the very last time he taught it in 2009, it was 300.
Mm-hmm. Let's have our next audience question. Welcome.
Hi, Jesse Rosenberg, host and producer of the Green Front Radio program. Yeah. I have been covering the Green Beat for 15 years. It's been long and lonely, pretty obsessed with climate change, but I'm relegated to the internet, waiting for mainstream media, syndicated and programmers to see that this is not a fringe, marginal content area, but something that is practical, not political, and would be of interest to mainstream Americans. I firmly believe that that's one of the missing pieces. We don't have a designated show, and I'm not just talking about begging and badgering mainstream media, you know, newscasters. Mentioned climate change once, or President Obama to mention it once, which is a good start, but we need to take this moment and turn it into momentum. Many of us were pleased to hear Obama, in response to a question at a news conference, say that we need to educate America. What role do you think there is in mainstream media and to try to get like designated shows that talk about this day in, day out, just as much as the fiscal cliff, the climate cliff, the ecological debt, and get all you wonderful experts, scientists, politicians, authors, experts on, so that the rest of America can hear this? Because I really think we're still on the fringes, and I really hope this is going to be the next wave talking about solutions. Now that we know it's here, what are we going to do about it? And there are people who know, but they're not getting out there.
Yes.
Catherine Hale.
The good news is that there are already some wonderful things happening. Here in the front row, we have Richard Alley, who is the star of Earth, the Operator's Manual. And if you want to see him doing some really interesting things, including bungee jumping, better you than me, it is a great series. There's a brand new series coming out on Showtime, going around interviewing people around the country, talking about impacts and how it's affecting our lives. So there's certainly things happening, but I think that increasing the awareness that this is an issue that matters to me in my life, where I live, it's not about the polar bears, it's not about the South Sea Islands, it's about me living in San Antonio, Texas, or me living in Concord, or in Seattle, or in Buffalo, or Miami. The extent to which we can make it directly relevant and interesting to people's lives, I think, the more interest there will be. And the more interest there will be, hopefully the more chances there will be to talk about it.
Let's have our next audience question.
Great.
Welcome
Thank
to the panel.
Thank you so much to each of you for coming. It's been a really interesting conversation. My name is Shauna Rappaport, and I want to draw on a couple of things that have actually just been brought up in these questions. I feel on the daily working as the education director with the Bioneers the power and passion of my generation in wanting to engage. And one of the things that I see so critically missing right now are clear pathways to support the translation of informed inspiration and this desire to engage and be a part of the solutions into direct action. And so I'm curious if you all can speak to, from your perspectives, what do you think, you know, if we had to list out, we have, some are saying now, a 3-year window to reduce our carbon emissions by 40%. How do we prioritize the really key leverage points, both in terms of reduction, is it a tax and rebate system, and in terms of real transition strategies that are going to make a difference, and that the general public, and particularly my generation of young people who want to be a part of the solution, to engage.
Thank you. I'd like to tackle that one.
that's a whole nother panel right there. Yeah. As scientists, our job is to hopefully try to synthesize the science to provide the best possible information to make those decisions. But honestly, I'm so thankful that I am not in policy making, because that is the hardest thing to do. Everything, there's pluses and minuses, there's long term, there's short term. But I believe that there is a great amount of low-hanging fruit. That is not my area of expertise, so I'm going what other people are telling me, but it seems like there's a lot of things that we could do that, leaving climate out of it, have immediate benefits. And why are we not doing those things?
Mike Mann?
Yeah, I would just add to that ultimately, you know, there's a worthy debate to be had about what policies to put in place to internalize the damage that the emission of carbon is doing to the planet. But ultimately, that's what we have to do. And, you know, there's a debate to be had about, should it be a carbon tax? Should we pass cap and trade legislation or fee and dividend? You know, there are now conservative groups that are advancing conservative, free market-oriented solutions to pricing carbon. Just the other day, David Frum, who is a pillar of the conservative movement, a former Nixon speechwriter, came out in support of a carbon tax. And so,
Yeah. Also, that's happened. The pledge, Grover Norquist came out for about 16 hours until he got whacked on the head in support of it. But that's definitely carbon tax is bubbling up as one possible option.
Right, and from sort of a surprising source from people on sort of on the conservative side of the political spectrum. And ultimately, this shouldn't be a partisan political issue, right? We all care about the future of this planet.
The day that Sandy hit, I was at the Hoover Institution with people from Republican administrations looking into this very thing. Bill Andrag?
Well, I was just going to build on that and say it's really a tragedy that it has become so politicized because, whether you like it or not, fires burn homes, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And it's the climate system doesn't care. And I think that's hopefully what we can do as scientists is provide the best assessment of risk and what are the climate risks and over what time scales and regions. And then we'll do our best to encourage action, but that's a whole different ballgame.
Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Carol Stone. Two very simple questions. One is, do you think the Mayan calendar passing this year will have any effect on the deniers? And the other is, what's the effect of the population in the world approaching 8 billion on all this issue of the carbon diet?
The population bomb, the population question. I think we may even have those authors in the room. Michael Mann, population.
Well, there are a number of factors that, when you look at global carbon emissions, there are a number of factors that determine, our emissions. And one of them, obviously, is the population. All other things being equal, if there are more people on the planet burning carbon for energy, we're going to be adding more carbon to the atmosphere. On the other hand, it also matters, people who are, living a Western-style existence use a lot more energy than people in, the developing world. And so one of the terms in that product of terms that from which we deduce, future carbon emissions is global population, and there's some uncertainty about that. Demographers tend to believe that global population will stabilize, below 10 billion people by the middle of this century because the developing world will take on some of the sort of characteristics of the Western world in terms of, their rates of reproduction, for example. And so when you look at some of those projections of future CO2 concentrations and future warming, built into many of them is the assumption that global population will actually stabilize sometime mid this century. If that doesn't happen, then it actually means the problem will be even worse than we typically project. And so that's a key uncertainty. It's a wild card in the equation.
I think that the bottom line really is not how many people there are in the world right now, but how many people want a U.S. lifestyle.
And what that U.S. lifestyle is.
Exactly. And that we can affect. We can affect the U.S. lifestyle.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Thomas Friedman writes about an Americum, that is 300 million people living at our high material standard of living, and then there's two or three Americums out there coming up and the implications for that. Let's have our next question. Yes, welcome.
Hi, my name is Wayne Roth. It's a bit intimidating to be in front of you and to be in front of you, sir. What will take us to make the sacrifices necessary to save our planet, to save not our planet, it'll survive, but civilization? My basic metaphor for what we're doing to the planet, a simple metaphor is putting a stick in a hornet's nest, but that doesn't give you any sense of the time this hornet's nest is going to be operating. I look at the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum, that lasted 100,000 years, maybe more, and what we're doing will raise the planet 5 or 6 degrees, and that'll take 100,000 years for weathering to pull it out of the system. When we were bombed in Pearl Harbor, we acted very quickly because there was a crisis that we all recognized. We don't recognize that we are in a Pearl Harbor right now, but it's spread in little incidences all over the planet, and nothing has raised the consciousness of the common people to the degree that we see, wow, we have to do something.
Let's take on that. Catherine Aho, we're not quite... where's the sense of urgency?
That's a lot to talk about, but that's a good... What will it take? Will it take another Hurricane Katrina? Will it take 10 years of drought in the Midwest so that we have no food to eat? Or, as you well point out, the snow plaque in the Sierras mm-hmm. becoming water that we're not designed to collect? Mm-hmm. What's it going to take? How many people in the United States will have to die before the United States political system recognizes and becomes the leader so that we can actually make some changes?
Mm-hmm. Bill Andre?
Well, it seems like one thing Steve Schneider always emphasized to his students is societal change takes time. And I think it's worth thinking about the metaphors we apply to dealing with climate change, because Pearl Harbor is one, and it's certainly an urgent one. But potentially something like the apartheid or civil rights movement, things that are every bit as urgent, but a lot more dispersed, and the time scales are a lot longer, and the actions you would take and how you would talk to people about it would be different. Mm-hmm. It could be a way to try and communicate this urgency in a lot more complex, rather than we've been bombed sort of scenario.
Yes. I think we can learn a lot from the past. Looking at the issue of slavery, with the issue of slavery, we were the bad guys that time also. That's part of it, is we're the bad guys this time, not the other people. So looking at the issue of slavery, it was a huge source of energy. It was the foundation of the economy. People were making the same arguments back then. It's not so bad. It will destroy the economy if we get rid of this. So I think that we have a lot to learn from that, from apartheid, from the way that we even handled the ozone hole problem. We have many examples we can build on from the past, but we have to recognize that it's hard looking ourselves in the face and realizing that we're the bad guys here. Admitting that we have a problem is the first step to finding a solution.
Getting off slavery didn't ruin the economy and didn't do a lot
yeah.
of things. That's all right. Yes, sir, welcome.
Hi. Nobody objects when a medical researcher says what needs to be done to save lives. But when a climate scientist says what needs to be done to save lives, people get upset. So do you think that expressing your personal values and political opinions undercuts confidence in your science?
Well, you know, one of the things that I...
The ambulance is not for you. It's okay. Yeah.
You never know. One of the things that I tried to stress in my book, actually, was, again, a theme that I touched on earlier, was the fact that this should not be a partisan political issue. And with the attacks that I was subject to by politicians looking to discredit my work in an effort to discredit the science of climate change, some of the heroes came from surprising, you know, what you might consider sort of surprising quarters. Probably the greatest sort of defender of us against the attacks by Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, who tried to subpoena all of my personal emails from my entire career in an effort to find something to discredit me with, presumably. It turned out it was a fellow Republican, Sherwood Bollert, the chair of the House Science Committee. He was an old-school, pro-science, pro-environmental Republican who came to defend my colleagues and me against this this political witch hunt by his own fellow Republican. And so I think you will find this among many of my colleagues and many climate scientists today. We do our best to frame this not as a partisan political issue, because it shouldn't be, and there's no reason for it to be. Unfortunately, it's a fact of life that it has become somewhat of a partisan political issue. But again, there is some evidence that there are, for example, people on the Republican side of the aisle that are now stepping up to the challenge of doing something about this problem.
I think that we sometimes make the mistake of thinking that science and values can provide the same information. I think that they're completely complementary in the sense of science is able to tell us what the problem is and what are the consequences of the choices we make. Our values are what have to inform those choices. What do we consider to be dangerous human interference with the climate system? A village in Alaska considers that it's already happened. A town in Texas might think it's not going to happen for another few decades or even longer. So we have to bring our values into it, because we're humans. Otherwise, we don't know what to do. Our values determine what is acceptable and what's not.
Let's get two more questions in here. Yes, sir, welcome.
Hi. There's been a lot of talk about Canada in and out throughout the discussion, and I'm wondering, as the tar sands in Alberta have become an increasing part of that province and the national economy there, have we seen a similar rise in climate denialism, or, for that matter, refusal to acknowledge any coming effects from climate change?
Yeah. Unfortunately, we have seen that, and some of it at a fairly high level. It turns out that a lot of the lobbyists and advisors who were behind some of the efforts to stifle scientists back in a previous presidential administration here in the U.S. Literally moved up to Alaska with the Harper administration, and they used the same playbook. Government scientists being censored, not being allowed to talk to the media about the threat to the environment from climate change. I have colleagues, scientists who study the impact of climate change on polar environments, who were told specifically that they were not allowed to talk to the media. And that was being orchestrated at a very high level within the Harper administration. And like I said, it was the same playbook that had been used previously in the U.S. And some of the same advisors and lobbyists who were running the show. I don't think that that is unrelated to some of what we've seen happen with policy with regard to the tar sands, the mining of the tar sands in Canada under this administration.
Let's have one more question. Yes, sir. Welcome.
Yes. John Addison, Clean Fleet Report. You mentioned hoping to hold the line at 450 parts per million. Given the long life of CO2 in the atmosphere, given feedbacks, how many billion metric tons are we pumping in this year? What are we going to have to do to get it down to hold it to that line?
Well, you know, the our awardee here today, James Hansen, has made a passionate argument for 450 ppm actually being too high, that even if we were to bring CO2 back to 350 ppm, that would barely be necessary to prevent some of the long-term changes that we may ultimately set in motion, even if we were to sustain CO2 concentrations at that level. And, of course, we're well above 350. We're now at 394 ppm. So, you know, there may not be a magic number. It's a matter of the extent of the risk and how much risk we want to subject ourselves to. It's sort of like, if you want to think of it as a freeway, you'd like to get off at the soonest exit ramp you can. But if you miss that first exit ramp, you still want to take the next one. It doesn't mean you stay on that freeway to oblivion. And so, you know, it... Bill McKibben, I think, has framed this pretty usefully, and he's done the numbers, I think, pretty carefully. We have five times as much fossil fuels already in available known reserves that we're ready to access. We have five times the amount that is necessary to give us 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, dangerous warming of the climate system. So we can't even afford to tap into the reserves that we already have available, let alone be exploring, investigating other additional reserves. That's the bottom line.
Any last word from Catherine or Bill?
I think it's hard to look this issue in the face often and not just lose hope. When we see that the science grows ever more certain year after year and our emissions continue to climb at 3% per year. Not only that, but over the past 10 years here in this country, the doubt regarding the seriousness of this issue has climbed as well. So you asked a little while ago, how do we get up in the morning? How does each of us get up in the morning? I have some assistance. I get hit over the head by a pillow pet most mornings. That usually gets me out of bed. But I think that we all have enormous hope and faith in the fact that the truth can win out, that we are survivalists. We want a better world. We want a better future. And with some work, I think we can get there.
Let's end it there. Catherine Hayhoe is professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech University. We've also been hearing from Bill Andreg, a postdoctoral student at Stanford University, and Michael Mann, professor of geosciences at Penn State. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you for coming and listening to Climate One today.
And now for something completely different.